In the 1969 Giro d'Italia, Eddie Merckx, the greatest cyclist in history, tested positive for banned stimulant Reactivan while leading the race. He claimed he was sabotaged, arguing that he was offered a bribe to lose the race and was framed when he refused.
Lei, signor Merckx, sostiene di non essersi drogato. Qual è stata la sua prima reazione non appena ha saputo che era stata trovata positività nelle sue analisi?
Poi io non so che dire, non capisco niente, perché io sono sicuro di aver preso niente, sicuro.
The same thing happened again at the 1973 Giro di Lombardia, where he tested positive for norepinephrine. After winning the race, he was disqualified, though the drug was subsequently removed from the banned list, and he argued it was an ingredient in a cough syrup prescribed for bronchitis. And then most notably, during the 1977 Tour of Flanders, Merckx was caught using the amphetamine-like stimulant, Pemoline, alongside fellow Belgian riders Freddy Martens and Michael Pollentier, after a new testing protocol was introduced. This turned fans against the Belgian superstar and the most controversial Tour of Flanders in history. Marco Pantani, one of the best climbers in the history of the sport, was named in a medical database seized by Italian police from the University of Ferrara, which tracked blood parameters managed by Dr. Francesco Concioni. Data from an encrypted file showed Pantani's hematocrit levels fluctuating from a baseline of 40.7% up to 58%, with independent records showing a rise to 60.1% following a 1995 crash. This increase, exceeding natural physiological limits, provided evidence of artificial EPO use, leading to a judicial conclusion of systematic doping. Pantani set the record for the fastest ascent of the famous mountain climb Alpe d'Huez in the Isère department of the Auvergne-Rhône-Alpes region. He ascended the full 13.8-kilometre climb, featuring 21 hairpin bends and an average gradient of 8.1% in just 36 minutes and 40 seconds during the 1995 Tour de France. This historic benchmark stood for 31 years as the ultimate symbol of the sport's high hematocrit EPO era, until Tadej Pogacar surpassed it during stage 19 of the 2026 Tour de France, with a time of 35 minutes and 26 seconds, almost a minute and a half quicker than Pantani. And sadly for Marco, he never outlived the Armstrong era, as personal troubles, drug addiction, and dangerous people saw him exit the sport, and ultimately cost him dearly.
On stage 16 to Morzine, Armstrong was put in some trouble by Jan Ulrich, but Pantani was unable to capitalise. An ill-judged escape saw him embarrassingly reeled in before he finally abandoned, claiming stomach problems. The press were calling him paranoid and fragile. Perhaps this was due to the cocaine he was now addicted to. Very quickly, his personality and his body began to fragment, until a second doping accusation in 2001 destroyed whatever confidence he had left. The spiral of decline was unstoppable. He was found dead and alone in a hotel room in Rimini in February 2004. He died from what doctors called acute cocaine intoxication. A desperate ending for a man who, for one brief moment, held the whole world in his hands.
This is my body, and I can do whatever I want to it. I can push it, study it, tweak it, listen to it. Everybody wants to know what I'm on. What am I on? I'm on my bike, busting my ass 6 hours a day, What are you on?
How could it have taken place when I've never taken performance-enhancing drugs?
Look, how could that have happened? That was my point. It's not just simply you don't recall.
How many times do I have to say it?
I'm just trying to make sure your testimony is clear.
Well, if it can't be any clearer than I've never taken drugs, then incidents like that could never have happened.
Vorne werden jetzt natürlich auch relativ schnell über Funk hören. Tade ist losgefahren und wenn sie dieses Pferd mit raus als Arensmann übergeben hat, ebenso.
Don't worry, we can get back into this. The adrenaline will be pumping now like you will not believe here. He's got to control it, otherwise he'll be winning the Tour de France right now, but he's not sure what's happening. There is Vinokourov in front. There is Ivan Meyer. He's the man who went down with Armstrong as well. Oh, what is going on? There's a problem with his pedals. This
is what happened. I think his pedal may have broken. This happened. He didn't hit anybody.
Fahr mit Schwung an ihnen vorbei, lass sie sofort stehen. Das ist eigentlich die klassische Vorgehensweise.
Das ist die große Frage. Jetzt fährt er sofort drüber, versucht also gleich zu beeindrucken, wenn er sofort drüber fährt oder.
Lang, schwer Tag mit der ansteigenden Zielgerade.
Jetzt hat er fährt. Warte, jetzt fährt er vorbei. Tank, oder?
Wahrscheinlich
nee, muss doch irgendwie, oder?
Wir brauchen eine andere Perspektive. Nein, die kämpfen sich noch durch, die beiden, die sind immer noch dran. Jetzt hat er 10 Meter, jetzt ist er wohl.
The Tour de France, the biggest cycling race in the world. It has been a theatre for some of the most immense athletic performances ever seen on Earth. However, this 3-week long tour of pure punishment, heat and exhaustion has also produced the greatest frauds in sporting history. Ever since its inception, cheating has followed the Tour de France in one form or another. From catching the train to cut out parts of the course, to using alcohol, stimulants, hormones, hidden motors, and even blood transfusions, the Tour de France has seen every iteration of cheater imaginable. The greatest Tour de France champion in history is Lance Armstrong, winner of 7 yellow jerseys between 1999 and 2005. For years, Armstrong was unbeatable, riding away in the mountains, making a mockery of his rivals, and doing so whilst claiming to be completely clean. Since then, however, Armstrong admitted to doing what he'd denied doing his entire career, doping. He admitted to using hormones, steroids, and blood transfusions live on television, shattering the belief of millions of fans worldwide. The scandal made the Tour de France synonymous with cheaters, breaking the faith that millions had in clean sport and athletic discipline. Ever since Armstrong was banned as well as others, cycling has continued to transition its identity and its technology. From 75kg winners down to 55kg winners, the competitors have been getting lighter, and so has the equipment. A modern Tour winner's bike weighs approximately 7.25kg, whereas the bikes ridden during Armstrong's era weighed around 7.75kg. which is only a small difference of approximately half a kilo. But modern champions rarely weigh over 70 kilos now, as lighter and lighter all-rounders have been claiming the top spots on podiums for years. Together with being lighter, Tour de France athletes are also eating far more carbohydrates, up to 150 grams per hour. That's the equivalent of eating about 5 tablespoons of white sugar every 20 minutes. For every gram of carbohydrate though, an extra 3 grams of water must be consumed. So despite being lighter, riders are carrying more water and glycogen weight than ever, as well as having larger leg muscle and less upper body muscle. Riders today are perfectly optimized to ride a bike as fast as humanly possible. But why are so many fans still accusing modern champions of cheating?
But he's just so ridiculously good. Like, you know, and maybe it's the, it's also cycling fans conditioned post that whole Armstrong era of being skeptical when someone has this much dominance. Is there a part of you worries that any of these performances aren't natural?
You know what? I mean, I've lived with it your whole career. You know, I even crossed over Armstrong at the end of his comeback year. And, you know, you just have to sit back and watch the sport as an entertainment thing. Because, you know, there's only one person who knows. And I mean, my performance has been questioned. You know, I won 2 monuments and stages of the tour, whatever, or not. And it's like, you have people on social media questioning you, you know, and I found myself pretty fortunate that most people believed in what I did, you know, which is really quite humbling that they trust me. You know, and it's, I think, yeah, watching the performances now, obviously it's, there is a lot of domination going on, but we just need to watch the sport for what it is, you know, and at the end of the day, it doesn't really, you know, it's just a case of, yeah, we're never going to know either way, you know, yeah. We might do. If something does happen, we might end up finding out something, but on the other side of it, it's like, it's just, it's an entertainment business, you know, and it's kind of you as a rider. Obviously, I was directly involved and were beaten by a lot of guys who tested positive afterwards. I mean, look at the 2009 top 10 in Giro de Lombardia. You know, I think I was 8th or 9th, and it's like there's a few guys on that list, you know, who were and it's looking back, it's just part of it, and obviously I was affected, but you just got to be at peace with it, you know, because it's just like a case of, well, it happened, you know, and it is what it is, and it's but yeah, I mean, it's as knowing the guy, a lot of the guys personally still, I'd hope that what we're seeing is pure, but you know, it's as I say, you know, there's only one guy, there's only that individual who knows.
Meanwhile, French newspaper L'Equipe yesterday ran the headline, "A domination that raises questions," in reference to Pogacar's performance and those massive power numbers, especially on Sunday stage, which Pogacar himself has said were his best ever. So his ascent of Plateau de Bay was 3 minutes and 40 seconds faster than Marco Pantani's record set almost 30 years ago, and Pogacar apparently rode it at an estimated 7 watts per kilo.
I've got some experience of doing 7 watts per kilo for a little bit longer than most people, I think. My max being maybe nearly 15 minutes. But even that was on like the greatest day I've ever had. Very fresh and completely peaking. When you put it into context, like what they're achieving, you know, at the end of the race, and obviously they're very well trained for this, it's what they train for. But still, it blew my mind when I first saw it.
Well, my opinion of it, if you look at Pantani's setup 30 years ago in comparison to what pros are riding now, it's a different world.
Mm.
It's a completely and utterly different world. And you can look at any other sector or nearly industry about what they're doing now versus 30 years ago, and it's just like a different world. Like cameras, phones,
yep,
cars, like computers, everything that we do, you can't compare now to what was happening 30 years ago. It's not the same world.
But has technology and fueling really advanced enough to justify beating a 31-year-long record holder from an era synonymous with EPO and blood doping? To find out, you must examine the differences in equipment used then compared to now. This is the bike of Marco Pantani used to conquer Alpe d'Huez in 1995. Despite being dated, it still largely resembles road bikes used today in its overall shape and design. What is not similar, however, is its exposed cabling, which increases drag although this is a minuscule difference and can be completely ignored on a climb like Alpe d'Huez. It is made from titanium, much different to modern carbon bikes. However, titanium is also very light, albeit slightly heavier than carbon fibre, but it's practically indestructible. As for the rest of the components, these have become obsolete now, but are nonetheless still beautifully engineered and relatively light despite their age. The total estimated weight of the bike comes in at around 7.6 to 7.8 kilograms, a mere 500 to 600 gram difference compared to modern bikes. Can a half kilogram difference really account for an almost entire minute and a half being taken off a blood-doped record of one of the most brutal climbs in cycling? And unlike the heavier champions of the past, Pantani was the exception. He was a pure climber, weighing almost 10 kilograms less than recent Tour de France winner Tadej Pogacar, meaning he didn't need to produce as much absolute power to climb as fast as other riders. What about fueling? Did Pantani know how to fuel? According to a legendary 90s tradition, team helpers would hand up a special, secret bottle in the closing miles. This often contained highly concentrated espresso, sugar, and sometimes painkillers and other stimulants to give a final kick for the finish. Mechanics would also shake cans of Coke to remove carbonation, giving riders a concentrated, easily digestible hit of sugar and caffeine right before a major climb. They would also regularly consume energy gels and energy bars, much like today's Peloton. In short, they were not stupid. These were highly experienced athletes. They knew how to fuel themselves. This leaves only the argument for better training and pacing to justify the huge performance boost required for a clean rider to beat such a hugely gifted doped-up rider like Marco Pantani.
Performance teams in World Tour squads now are huge. Those teams are investing millions each year just into the salaries of those performance teams because they know that they need to.
The Tour de France, they're racing a lot on newly resurfaced roads, on silky, smooth, brand new tarmac versus something like chip seal.
It's always a real pleasure to ride on brand new tarmac. We actually recently did a video highlighting just how much difference just a single motorbike makes. Effectively, you've got a whole convoy in front in the peloton and behind, presumably just pushing the air in that direction the whole day.
It is true that performance teams have grown in recent years, but so have team budgets. Professional cycling teams are effectively businesses, and as businesses grow, they invest in more specialist staff, and larger budgets naturally support larger teams. Seeing performance teams expand is a luxury afforded to modern-day teams that have more money. But they are not necessarily growing because they have to. Newly resurfaced roads are a benefit at higher speeds, but at lower speeds, the improvements become negligible. As for Alpe d'Huez, although many sections have been resurfaced, much of the road is still the same surface that Pantani rode up in 1995. Although not quite as smooth, it is not a rough surface by any means. The time gains may save 1 or 2 watts, which may at best yield a 5 to 10 second improvement over the course of the entire climb. As for drafting, the advantage is also negligible on a low-speed ascent. In any case, there were convoys of motorbikes and cars in 1995 as well. If Marco Pantani's 1995 ride up Alpe d'Huez was significantly enhanced by doping, how fast would a completely clean Pantani have climbed Alpe d'Huez? 1 minute slower? 2 minutes? 3? And if a clean Pantani really was several minutes slower, then another question follows. Are modern advantages really large enough to make up that gap? Today's bikes are a little lighter, and tyres roll slightly faster as well. The road surface is smoother in places. Riders have better nutrition, better pacing, and more scientific training. But how much are those improvements actually worth? Seconds? Tens of seconds or several minutes? If they are only worth a relatively small amount of time, then what does that imply about comparing modern climbing records with performances from the EPO era? The team at the top of cycling in 2026 is UAE Team Emirates XRG. His team principal, Mauro Gianetti, is a former professional who raced through the heavily doped 1990s alongside Marco Pantani and Lance Armstrong. In 1998, he collapsed during the Tour de Romandie and spent days in intensive care. Doctors reportedly suspected the experimental blood substitute perfluorocarbon, although this was never proved and Gianetti denies having used EPO or other doping products. The case remained unresolved, with reporting stating that his medical records were not supplied to investigators. Gianetti later managed Sonia Doval, alongside UAE sports manager Jose Fernandez, or Matchin. That team became associated with several major doping cases. Iban Mayo tested positive for EPO. Ricardo Rico tested positive for CERA during the 2008 Tour de France. Leonardo Pioppoli later tested positive for CERA. And Juan Jose Cobo was eventually stripped of his 2011 Vuelta victory because of biological passport anomalies. The Riccio and Pioppoli scandal forced Sonia Doval to withdraw from the 2008 Tour de France and contributed to the team's collapse. Separately, UAE state-backed sponsorship has been criticised as sports washing because the team promotes the country internationally while human rights groups criticise the UAE government's record. Given the history of the management behind UAE Team Emirates XRG, as well as the questions surrounding the ethics of its state-backed sponsorship, is it unreasonable for fans to view the team's extraordinary dominance with a greater degree of scepticism? Whatever the case, modern cycling has become divided. Many long-term fans are starting to struggle to believe in clean cycling anymore, whereas many new fans enjoy the domination and sheer strength being shown by the new Eddy Merckx. I leave by saying, cycling is a beautiful sport, and I, like many of you watching, love it despite its imperfections. But what do you think? Please let me know your opinions below and consider subscribing. Most viewers are not yet subscribed, so it'd be really great if you considered it by pressing the subscribe button and the notification bell to be informed of any future uploads. Thank you again for watching, and I'll see you in the next video.